4th, I plan to have the CS ready and move this bill from House Finance, if it's the will of the committee. My office will also be providing each member's office with a notebook of presentations and documents relating to each day's topic. These documents will also be provided to members in their daily House Finance packets, as well as being placed on bases for the public. Here to introduce Senate Bill 74 is Senator Kelly, and from his staff, Heather Shattuck, and from and Stacy Crayley from the Department of Law. Please come to the table, Senator, and introduce yourself and begin your presentation. Okay. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I clarify, did you want, as we go through the sectional questions, wait until the end, or can we ask if it's specific to the sectional?
I think we should wait till the end and Senator Kelly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing SB 74. I'll make a few opening comments, and I'm going to have to go, and you have a massive amount of people here to explain this bill to you in whatever depth you want to get into.
Representative Munoz is joining us also. Okay.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I just want to communicate. I know some of the feelings that I have about Medicaid that you have to share, having been a co-chair of finance, and as likewise Chairman Newman. Every day or every year you come in, you have a major task in front of you to prepare a budget for the state. Probably the first thing you ask yourself is, how much did Medicaid grow last year? That thing is going to eat the budget one of these days if we don't do something about it. It just grows and grows. In the 90s, I remember at one time we were dealing with a $130 million increase in Medicaid. It was only one year, but the other years were pretty high too, but that was the worst I can remember. Along with the consternation that members have felt as Medicaid grows, many people have recommended doing something about it, and they have, with the best of intentions and expertise, put forward Medicaid reform bills that were different from this bill, I think, in one respect, and it is an important respect, in that in the past, the way we reformed Medicaid or attempted to reform Medicaid was by restricting access rather than actually reforming the system. It caused it to fail almost every time. There were some reforms, but there were never reforms that were on such a global scale that you could say, wow, we did it here. We stopped the growth of Medicaid. And so this bill attempts to not to restrict access. It's to look at the system itself and say, where are the places in the system that are operating counter to just best practices? What is available in the world of technology today to assist us? What models are out there that allow us to operate more intelligently as we distribute this necessary service? So that's a real general overview of it. Some of the things that you'll be looking for in there that are the kind of hip pocket things that most people, most of your constituents would understand. Things like telemedicine. It's like getting out of the buggy whip days and into the days of the automobile. It's time we enacted telemedicine in Medicaid. Many times we've talked about the grouping of a healthcare authority, creation of a healthcare authority. It didn't really work until now, and it has to do with the financial situation of the state, where we can actually not only group all of the municipal and state healthcare plans, but also Medicaid, which is just a huge portion of the healthcare spending in this state, to create security in numbers, a bigger thing so you can negotiate better to get a better cost. There are things in there regarding coordinated care. So many times we hear about the problems about emergency room use, about the poor use of pharmacies through using designer drugs rather than generic drugs and other things regarding pharmacies. Travel. Travel is not necessarily abused. It's just used so poorly and coordinated so poorly that we waste a tremendous amount of money. the numbers that I hear, we spend $79 million on Medicaid travel. There, travel is necessary, and I think sometimes when you talk to a person who hasn't dived into the intricacies of how Medicaid is distributed, they say, well, what do you mean we pay for travel? Well, we probably need to pay for travel in a lot of respects, but what we've found is that in some places the mom comes into Anchorage from a distant community for a well baby check on Thursday, and by the following Monday, she's bringing her son in for dental work, and we could have coordinated that. And so coordinated care and saved a tremendous cost to the state. Coordinated care will do that. It'll also help the emergency room misuse because it gives people a place to go for their care on a consistent basis, and someone who can direct them in a proper way rather than the desperation that some people feel that they just have to go to the emergency room because they really don't have any other alternatives. People generally abuse the system, not necessarily intentionally, but because they've run out of options, and coordinated care will do that. There's provisions in here for behavior health. We've allowed that to get out of control, and there are some reforms regarding that. And I could go on. It's a fairly complex bill. My apologies. I'm not a believer in these huge omnibus bills. But if we're going to reform Medicaid, as many shots as we've taken at it and failed, this is an interesting time when we have the administration and the majority working together. And I just really want to compliment the administration at the amount of work that they put in and the great help that they've been to put this piece together. So we're not arguing about what's in this bill. Most of that has been cleaned up. That doesn't mean there aren't things that you'll catch, obviously, and things may develop as time goes by. But in general, the administration and the majority agree on this bill. And I think with that, Mr. Chairman, I would just turn over questions to Ms. Shattuck or the people from the administration who are here. As I said, they can answer at a much greater depth than I can go into.
Senator, I want to thank you for being here to make opening comments on the bill. Again, we've been joined by Representative Edgman and Representative Garris, so we do have a full committee. And to remind everybody again that we will be having multiple meetings on all the different topics and by topic. So if we could limit our questions so that we can give them a chance to do their jobs and make a proper presentation. Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At a high level, I don't want to dive into too much detail, but there's a lot of detail in a good bill. Senator Kelly, through the chair, tell us, thank you. What initiatives or what areas did you consider but decide not to include in this bill? There's a lot that is in it, but there's almost an infinite range of Medicaid reform measures. What did you consider but not take up or worked on and abandoned?
I'm going to hand that off to Ms. Shattuck, because if I think about it, I would come up with a few, but I'd probably have to think too long, and the committee has to be moving along. Mr. Chairman, may I leave? I have some other business I have to attend to on the other side. Thank you.
And we are going to have the presentation of the bill. Representative Newman had a question about your presentation, though.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Ms. Shattuck, as you go through the presentation on the overview or through the different parts of this, could you differentiate which portions were added by the administration and which portions were originally part of the Senate's discussions?
Through the chair, Rep. Newman, absolutely. I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Shattuck, place yourself on the record, please, and sure. Hear your presentation, and maybe you can answer the questions. Mm-hmm. Again, we can limit the questions because we are going to be covering all the topics in each different meeting. We're planning on having multiple meetings on this, hopefully to have a CS by April 4th and get it passed out of committee.
Representative? I would have drawn my question if it just been this time.
Ms. Shattuck, go right ahead.
Okay. For the record, Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Pete Kelly, and just for the record, Rep. Sadler, at the end, I'd be happy to answer that question. That way you'll have an idea of what's considered so far. So with the introduction that Senator Kelly gave, I'll just start the walkthrough of the sectional, if that works, Mr. Chair. So sections 1 through 7 are related to telehealth, and this came from Senate Bill 98. And then when Senate Bill 98 came to Senate Finance, we incorporated those provisions into SB 74. Some of these sections open up telehealth for the use of behavioral health. Section 1 allows telehealth to be used for licensed professional counselors. And this was just one tool to open up the provider pool for behavioral health. I can certainly speak for Fairbanks. We have a great shortage of behavioral health providers. And if you can imagine this, we cannot get psychiatrists to come and move and live in Fairbanks, Alaska. As well as we have a shortage of counselors and other needed behavioral health providers. And I know Fairbanks is not alone in that. So opening up telehealth for these kind of providers is just one way to help address our behavioral health provider shortages. Section 2 opens up telehealth for marital and family therapists. Section 3 is telehealth for physicians, and this is on page 3, line 21 of the bill through page 4, line 9. In this provision specifically, there it tells the Board of Medicine to adopt regulations that establish guidelines for a physician who is rendering a diagnosis, providing a treatment, or prescribing, dispensing, or administering a prescription drug to a person without conducting a physical exam. And the guidelines must include a nationally recognized model policy for standards of care of a patient who is at a different location than the physician. Section 4 is, again, telehealth with the state medical board, and that's on page 4, lines 10 through 29. And this prohibits the state medical board from imposing disciplinary sanction on a physician for rendering a diagnosis, providing treatment, or prescribing, dispensing, or administering a prescription drug that is not a controlled substance without an in-person physical exam first. And this is allowed if the physician or another licensed healthcare provider or a physician in their group practice can provide follow-up care, and the physician follows patient consent protocols for sending their medical records of the encounter to the person's primary care provider, if that person is not the primary care provider. Specifically, this section removes the current prohibition that the provider, if they're doing telehealth, must be physically located in the state of Alaska. This is one of those tools that will not only open up the providers, which we are short primary care providers as well as behavioral health providers, but this is just an arbitrary barrier. These physicians will still be licensed and regulated by the state medical board. Nothing gets rid of that. And this is just one of those tools that can also help drive down the overall cost of medical care in the state of Alaska. We have the highest cost of care in the country, and therefore probably the world. So we just need to do everything we can to drive that cost down. Section 5 is, again, telehealth for physicians. It starts on page 4, line 30, and goes through page 5, line 11. It amends by allowing a controlled substance or Botox to be prescribed, dispensed, or administered via telemedicine only if another appropriate licensed healthcare provider is physically present with the patient to assist. This is in recognition that some drugs like controlled substances, you really need that extra in-person exam on the other end. So that puts sideboards on those kind of controlled substances. And subsection D sets out that an abortion-inducing drug can only be prescribed in accordance with AS 18-16010. Those are the current abortion statutes. And it sets out an extra patient safety by not allowing a physician to prescribe, dispense, or administer a prescription drug if they're just responding to an email message or an internet questionnaire. We certainly don't want doc-in-the-boxes from other countries or other states operating in Alaska. That is not best practice, and that certainly is not the intent of this bill. And finally, the last telehealth provision, two provisions are Section 6, which opens up telehealth for psychologists and psychological associate examiners. That's on page 5, line 12. And Section 7 opens up telehealth for social workers, which is on page 5, lines 28 through page 6, lines 12. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn it over to Stacy to do some of the fraud provisions.
Go ahead and place yourself on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stacy Crayley. I'm a Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And I'm going to speak right now about Sections 8 through 12, which relate to the creation of a new cause of action within the state of Alaska, which we have captioned or titled the Alaska Medical Assistance False Claims and Reporting Act, Section 8 and Section 9 deal with statute of limitations provisions related to this new cause of action. And Section 10, I'm on page 6 through page 14, is the bulk of these provisions. And what this provision does is it creates a state False Claims Act, which mirrors the Federal False Claims Act, which is a statute that has been in been on the United States Code since right after the Civil War. And what a False Claims Act does is it creates a mechanism whereby an individual may pursue and identify fraud and waste within government programs. States don't have to have these. Some states do. There's probably 18 or 19 different states in the country right now that have False Claims Acts related to Medicaid programs, and this section here, 10, is what we've we're trying to do the same thing for here, for the state of Alaska. Just to kind of highlight a couple of the critical points of the False Claim Act, there are so the idea is that an individual come forward and identify fraud or abuse. When they file their lawsuit, that lawsuit must be filed under seal and served contemporaneously on the Department of Law. The Department of Law will then have 60 days to investigate the merit of those claims. And at the end of those 60 days, the Department of Law has three options, one of which is to move to dismiss the case because they find that the claim doesn't have merit. The Department of Law can take over the litigation, or the Department of Law can defer to the individual who has brought the case forward to pursue the claim on behalf of the state of Alaska. The premise of a False Claims Act is when these individuals participate is that they then get a portion of the recoveries. So if you bring a claim, the individual is entitled to 35% of the recovery. And if the I think that's correct. And if they don't bring the claim, they're always going to get a portion of the recovery. And if they get if the state takes it but doesn't allow the individual to bring it forward, then the state keeps they still get a recovery of that, and the state keeps the rest of it. So 25%. The realtor will be awarded 15% to 25% of the total award. Relator, or if the Attorney General defers, then they get a greater recovery, 25% to 30% of the award. The remainder would then come back to the state. Another interesting provision of the False Claims Act is that there is a whistleblower protection within the framework, which allows an individual who is working for a provider to be able to report the fraud or abuse and to assure that they're not going to be terminated from their employment. A couple of things that happened in the other body is that there was some concerns about frivolous lawsuits and trying to protect from individuals bringing lack of merit claims. Well, we believe that the three provisions and the ability of the Attorney General to dismiss these claims is a robust protection for frivolous claims. But in addition, and we'll talk about this a little bit further, there were the other body decided to sunset the whistleblower, the individual plaintiff's provision, within 3 years. So we'll come back, should this bill pass, we would come back in 3 years and present evidence to the legislature about whether or not these claims were successful, if they were frivolous, and be able to identify whether or not that provision should go forward. The final point I'd like to make about the false claims provision is that if we are successful in passing this bill and it is approved by the federal government, as most of you know, that when we receive overpayments and recoveries from providers, there's a the department gets there's just like our payment is, there's a 50-50 split. If we have a certified False Claim Act, then the state of Alaska is entitled to an enhanced match on those recoveries. And it's between a 5% and a 10% swing, so it's a significant incentive to the state to have a False Claim Act. That this provision right now is currently with the Office of Inspector General for preview and determination of whether or not they would certify it, and we're comfortable that they will because it's based upon their guidelines, and we feel comfortable that that will happen. But that's another incentive for doing that. As I mentioned on the other body, they identified a sunset provision to address the concerns of some providers about frivolous lawsuits. In Section 11 and 12 are provisions that relate to that. It's a little complicated, but in a nutshell, these two provisions relate to the investigation, the 60-day investigation I mentioned earlier. What the drafter legislative legal did is they've taken these two sections and they've continued these despite the repeal or the sunset to allow these sections to continue forward, simply for the Department of Law to have those tools, even though there isn't if the bill sunsets at that point, we still needed these tools for subpoena and for the whistleblower provision. So those are just technical fixes that relate to the sunset provision.
And through the chair, for the record, sections 8 through 12 came out of the governor's SB 78, and so that was the CS that was rolled out this year, and we incorporated those. And as Ms. Crayley said, when we added the sunset, sections 11 and 12 were added by the Senate Finance Committee. Sections 13 through 19 are all related to the prescription drug monitoring program. This was added through the Senate Subcommittee on Medicaid Reform and then adopted by the entire Senate Finance Committee. Section 13 amends the program by only requiring data collection for prescribing, administering, or dispensing federal Schedule 2, 3, and 4 controlled substances. Right now we have in state schedules and federal schedules, and through our subcommittee process, we found out that we really don't need the state schedules in there. That's used by law enforcement and not used by prescribers or dispensers that are using have a federal DEA number. So they're using just the federal schedule. So in order to clean up the PDMP, or the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program database, we just reduced it down to federal Schedule 2, 3, and 4. Just for some background information, the highest number are the most potent. So federal Schedule 1 are drugs that actually have no medical use, and marijuana is included in there. And per the ballot initiative, we cannot have any database on marijuana, so you really don't want that in there. And then there's federal 2, 3, and 4 that we will collect, and federal Schedule 5 has a very low likelihood of any kind of addiction or bad interaction, so it wasn't necessary to include that. Section 14 amends the requirements for data collection and amends by requiring the database to be updated at least on a weekly basis. Currently, it is updated on a monthly basis, and we're the only state that updates ours that infrequently. And just as some background, all of these recommendations that are in sections 13 through 19 came from the Controlled Substance Advisory Council. There will be, if you do not have it already, a white paper in your packets, especially for the day we do a dive into this topic. Section 15 amends who has access to the database, and that is on page 16, lines 27 through page 18, line 16. We've heard some feedback from folks that were prescribers or dispensers that said, hey, we would really be interested in using this, but this is a little timely for us, and it would be really helpful if we could delegate access. So number 3 allows a licensed practitioner to delegate database access to supervised employees or clinical staff. Number 4 allows the same thing for pharmacists. Number 7 adds a new section to authorize database access to the State of Alaska Medicaid Pharmacy Program. We have a Medicaid pharmacist, and she is not allowed access to the database. Number 8 adds a new section to authorize the database access to the State of Alaska Medicaid Drug Utilization Review Committee for utilization review of prescription drugs provided to Medicaid recipients. Number 9 adds a new section to authorize database access to the State of Alaska Medical Examiner. They're required to do autopsies on deaths that are suspicious and other things like that, so this would be a tool to help them see if somebody was on opioids or other controlled substances that might have led to a suspicious death. And Section 10 adds a new section to authorize de-identified data access to the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services Division of Public Health. The Division of Public Health would not need specific information to fulfill public health objectives. And one of the things we wanted to make sure was that they would not otherwise be able to identify who these individuals are. So the provisions around them having access in the bill specifically says that it could only be done on a regional basis. So the commissioner assured me that that would be looking at like the entire Bethel region or the entire Nome region, consistent with what they're already doing.
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on Section 5, number 8, the last two words, and I heard the presenter say Medicaid assistance, although it says medical assistance.
Oh, sure.
And I just wanted clarification, if you will.
Yes, for the record, Rep. Gaddis, in the statutes, it's actually referred to as a recipient of medical assistance, which we all know as the Medicaid program.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Continue.
Section 16, which is on page 18, line 17, is the section that requires folks to actually register to use the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program database. So this will require all prescribers and all pharmacists to register with the Controlled Substance Prescription Database, and failure to register is grounds for the board to take disciplinary action against the license or registration of the pharmacy or pharmacist. Section 17, which is on page 18, line 23, this is about civil immunity, and the civil immunity remains for using this database even with this change from the program being optional to mandatory, and it just removes the language from the statute that kept use of the database as optional. Section 18 is on page 19, line 1, and this is about the board regulations, and this database sits in the Board of Pharmacy, so that is who the regulations are regarding. Number 3 amends to ask the board to set a procedure and time frame for registration for use of the database. Number 4 is where we require prescribers and pharmacists to review the Controlled Substance Prescription Database before prescribing, administering, or dispensing a Federal 2, 3, or 4 controlled substance to a patient. However, we added some exemptions, so those are listed on A through D. That's lines 16 through 21 of the bill. We heard some feedback and some testimony from some emergency room docs, as well as other folks, that there are just times where they're not going to be able to look up somebody before prescribing or dispensing. So if you have somebody walk into an emergency department with a gunshot wound, our doctors need to be able to respond to them immediately and give them pain medication. So it doesn't inhibit best practice of that. So the exemptions are for an inpatient setting, at the scene of an emergency or in an ambulance, in an emergency room, or immediately before, during, or within the first 24 hours after surgery. And finally, the last section about the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program is Section 19, and that's pages 19, line 22, through page 20, line 4. And this is adding new subsections O that require prescribers and pharmacists to review the database when prescribing or dispensing a federal Schedule 2, 3, or 4 controlled substance to a patient. It requires notification to the boards when a practitioner registers with a database. It authorizes the Board of Pharmacy under Q to forward unsolicited notifications to prescribers and dispensers of database information about patients who might be obtaining controlled substances that are inconsistent with generally recognized standards of care. And R is where we ask them to collect dispensing data and update the database at least on a weekly basis. And then I will turn sections 20 and 21 back over to Stacy.
Again, for the record, Stacy Crayley. And section 20 and 21 again relate back to the Alaska Medical Assistance False Claim and Reporting Act. Section 20 is simply a designation that the money or monetary recoveries that we receive under this False Claim Act will be added to AS 3705-146C, which is basically a designated receipt fund for Medicaid money. Because of the federal match in there, it shouldn't go back to the general fund. It goes into this dedicated fund. Section 21 is an amendment to the Alaska Public Records Act. And what this does is it says it provides protection of that information that is provided and served under seal while the Department of Law is reviewing the merits of the claim, that we would be able to keep that information from being subject to a Public Records Act. Once a lawsuit is filed or a claim is actually brought forward in court, those protections would be lost, but the actual information would be limited to a non-disclosure for the period of that investigation.
For the record, Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Kelly. Section 22 is a telemedicine business registry, and that's on page 20, line 11. This was part of Senate Bill 98, again, that got rolled into Senate Bill 74. And this registry, I believe, was added by the Labor and Commerce Committee in the Senate. And it establishes within the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development a telemedicine business registry of businesses performing telemedicine services in the state. That was added after some feedback from doctors and the medical association that they wanted to make sure we knew who was doing business in the state. It also just offers some comfort if there is a telemedicine provider who's maybe a bad actor, we can at least go to their company and say, hey, you know, just so you know, you might want to have a tighter rein on this particular doctor. Section 23 is somewhat of an original section to Senate Bill 74 that was added in the Senate State Affairs Committee. It's on page 20, line 26. It allows the Department of Health and Social Services to enter into a contract through the competitive bidding process under the State Procurement Code for durable medical equipment or other services that can be provided on a statewide basis, such as travel. Section 24 was part of Senate Bill 74 as well, and this was a section added in Senate State Affairs that we expanded on and got a little better in Senate Finance Committee, and this is an enhanced computerized eligibility verification system. This is on page 21. It starts on line 1. And this is a system that would complement our current eligibility system, which is known as ARES. That is in the Division of Public Assistance. So subsection A directs the department to establish a computerized income asset and identity eligibility verification system for the purpose of verifying eligibility, eliminating duplication of state public assistance payments, and deterring waste, fraud, and abuse in the public assistance programs. Subsection D directs the department to enter into a competitively bid contract with a third-party vendor for this eligibility verification system. And the department can also contract with this vendor to provide information to facilitate reviews of recipient eligibility conducted by the department. So they would look at, you know, when you first come in and are seeing if you're eligible, they would look at that. And then every 6 months or so, it comes back and they do what the department calls redeterminations. So this software would be used in both processes. Subsection C requires the annual savings to the state resulting from the use of the system to exceed the cost of implementing the system. And then subsection D requires that the contract be awarded to a vendor that is not awarded the contract for the entire eligibility system in order to avoid a conflict of interest. So that's where it would be separate but complement areas. It would be integrated. The whole point was not to have another clunky database, but something that would go out and scan. So these systems actually scan more than our current eligibility system. They'll go out and make sure that these folks don't have property, other holdings, that they only have one ID. And we've heard from other states that they've really been able to crack down on folks who are not eligible. And then I will turn it back over to Stacy.
Again, for the record, Stacy Crayley. Section 25 amends current Alaska statute, and this comes from Senate Bill 78. Current statute at AS 4705-200 requires the department to engage in not less than 75 audits per year of enrolled providers. The amendment to this statute is designed to reduce that number to 50. And the reason why we are seeking for that reduction is that at the time that the bill was, the statute that we're amending went into effect, there weren't very many audits being done by Medicaid providers. Since that time, there has been a proliferation of audits by both the federal government and by private insurance companies and other individuals. So there's providers have a lot of audits and requirements. So we felt that we could reduce the number to 50. We work collaboratively with the federal government with their audits so we don't duplicate, but also we get the benefit of their audit findings and they get the benefit of our audit findings. So this was a thinking that we could reduce the burden on the providers while still not losing the benefit of the reviews. So the amendment is to reduce the audits by so that we don't have to do anything less than 50 per year, and there's a further amendment which basically indicates that when we do this that we will minimize duplication of these audits going forward. Section 26 also came from Senate Bill 78, and this is a an amendment to the same same statutory provision, which asks the legislature for the ability to assess interest and penalties on identified and established overpayments. One of the things that was discovered in the other body when we were working on this is that originally the amendment indicated that the overpayment and interest and penalties would accrue at the moment the final audit was issued. We've amended that in this version to allow for interest and penalties to begin accruing at the point that the audit would be appealed, and if not appealed, then penalties and interest would accrue on that date, or if appealed, after the completion of the administrative hearing where they may be challenged the overpayment finding. So the imposition of interest and penalties is akin to what would happen in a superior court litigation. So if somebody were challenging the overpayments, they wouldn't be subject to interest and penalties, but once they challenged and had lost, then those penalties would start accruing. Section 27 also comes from Senate Bill 78. This is a new section which requires providers to engage in a self-audit of their claims. There are a few changes that were made in the other body related to concerns that were raised. Specifically, what we're asking providers to do here is to identify a statistically valid sample of claims and to audit those claims, which is how we audit providers, so we felt that was fair. Secondarily, that at the end of that we weren't going to ask audits to do this on an annual basis, but on a biannual basis, again, going back to the previous section about the number of audits. And we also don't expect a provider to do a self-audit in a year that they're being audited by the state or the federal government, so there's no duplication of that. But we felt that when they're not under these audits, the 50 or whatever, or the federal government, that they should be engaging in some due diligence in reviewing their claims and reporting and identifying overpayments. Another section in this, another provision of this section is that once you identify the overpayment and you report to the department and work on a payment plan, we would not assess penalties or interest on that self-identified overpayment. It's kind of a benefit for you coming forward and saying we've made a mistake and we're going to pay you back. So there would be no penalties assessed on that overpayment finding. Section 28 is a new section related to civil penalties, and what this does is it gives the administration, the Department of Health and Social Services, another tool in their toolbox in dealing with program integrity and provider compliance. Under the current regulatory scheme, the department has their penalties range from termination from the program to provider education, and there's really no middle ground within those sanctions. And the department would like to have the authority to impose fines for different sanctionable offenses, which this section would allow for as a means to maintain program integrity and to allow providers to remain open and give the department just an additional tool in their toolbox.
Representative Guerra, on that section.
Yeah, just a legal question, not a policy question, on penalties. Can we constitutionally give the executive the power to establish penalties? Just a legal question. Can we constitutionally, the legislature in a bill, give the administration the power to set legal penalties? It says by regulation they'll establish them between $100 and $25,000. And I've never seen a provision where we've given that power away to the executive.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's exactly why we've asked for this, is because absent the delegation from the legislature to the department to impose these fines and these penalties under the sanction provisions, we don't believe we have the authority to do that. And in light of the fact that I believe under the administrative code there's a list of 60-some different sanctions, to ask the legislature to walk through and do all of that, to identify what would be the fine there. We felt that we could do this through regulation and provide a very nominal fine. And again, we've done that. And yes, the legislature has provided the ability for the executive branch to impose fines in other regulatory arenas. So we're just...
Go ahead.
Through the chair. So and it's really just a question, but we can, the legislature can constitutionally let the executive decide what conduct results in what penalty amount?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the provisions already exist as to what is a what is sanctionable. What we're asking for is the ability to have a potential fine attached to that. And yes, we believe that the legislature can give the department the authority to impose those fines through a regulation.
Continue, Ms. Grayley.
Thank you. Further provision of that section is to identify the administrative review of a fine that is assessed so that we can how certain fines of a dollar amount would be reviewed internally and a higher fine amount would go to the office administrative hearings. If there were still disputes any, you know, with the lower fines, those would then go to the office administrative hearings. The next section is on page 24. Again, also comes from Senate Bill 78, and it relates to the seizure and forfeiture of rural or personal property and medical assistance fraud cases. And what this section does is it creates a system of seizure and freezing and seizing certain real property or personal property to offset the cost of identified fraud. So, upon the discovery of a fraud case by the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, they could seek permission to the court, make an evidentiary finding to the court, and the court could authorize the state to seize certain assets or place liens on certain assets so that they weren't disposed of while a Medicaid fraud case was being investigated. Upon the completion of that case, the Department of Law would have to go into court, make a further evidentiary finding, and if authorized by the court, could then dispose of those assets to offset the cost of the fraud that had been established through the criminal case. This section only relates to the seizure and forfeiture of claims that are brought by the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit and are simply limited to those types of cases.
Mr. Chair, the rest of this section 28 is about the medical assistance reform program and just how this bill is drafted. We have a couple of sections that are awfully long, and this is one of them. So I'm on page 25, line 16. And the rest of this section was part of Senate Bill 74 in its original form. We've amended a few things along the way. But subsection A directs the department to design and implement a program for reforming Medicaid, and the reform program must include 11 items in this version. Number one is referrals to community and social support services, including career and educational training opportunities through the Department of Labor, the University of Alaska, and others. So the state has a lot of training opportunities through our current network of job centers, vocational rehabilitation centers, Workforce Investment Act programs, vocational training programs, and supports through our extensive nonprofits that provide services and case management. And we truly believe that jobs are the path to self-sustaining and improved self-image. If you talk to some Medicaid recipient providers, they have been told that, you know, they're too disabled to work, and that's just flat out not true. There's many of them that once they find a job that they want to do are giving back to the community through education or through work, and we just feel like that they should be directed to those supports as an option. Number two is an electronic distribution of an explanation of benefits, and this is another tool just to allow recipients of Medicaid to check that providers are billing the state for services they actually received. Number three is expanding the use of telemedicine or telehealth for primary care, behavioral health, and urgent care. Number four is enhancing fraud prevention, detection, and enforcement. Number five is reducing the cost of behavioral health, senior, and disability services provided to recipients of medical assistance under the state's home and community-based services. There's a waiver section that's later on that'll point to some of the specifics we tell the department to apply to that will help implement this section. Number six is pharmacy initiatives. And this could be, again, expanding on what the department's already done by including using generic medications, claims pricing and payment reforms, prior authorizations, and the use of the prescription drug control database. Number seven is enhanced care management. So this could be set up in a couple of different ways to teach the proper use of the healthcare system. I don't know about you, but when I first used my health insurance, it was pretty overwhelming as a fresh out of college individual, and it's not intuitive. Our healthcare system is pretty scary to approach. So we really focus on the use of a primary care case management with the use of a patient-centered medical home is just one option. And this is where a Medicaid user, who is often a super utilizer, is assigned a primary care provider to oversee their care. And they would have access to preventative care, primary care, vaccines, flu shot, and other appropriate care. So another example of this type of enhanced care management could be special treatment for identified needs. So, for example, if you have somebody that has diabetes, they're going to need regular care for that special population. Just like asthma, somebody who's pregnant, you might want to make sure they're going to their prenatal care. They know all of the tools they need, so that way when they have a healthy baby, they're ready to hit the ground running as a strong parent. Number eight is redesigning the payment process that includes fee agreements for performance measures that include A is premium payments for centers of excellence, B is penalties for hospital-acquired infections, readmissions, and failure outcomes, C is bundled payments for specific episodes of care, D is global payments, those are used for a specific diagnosis or primary care managers. So we have a pretty costly fee-for-service program. We are one of the only states, I think us and Wyoming are the only two states that are purely using a fee-for-service program right now. So that means we are paying for volume instead of value. So this is one of the tools where we are trying to change our payment structure into something that looks a little different and is paying for that value. So this is something Medicare has done, and many other states have started implementing fee agreements like global payments or bundled payments. One example is if you went into the hospital and got a knee replacement, the hospital would be paid one fee for everything they did related to that knee replacement. Instead of them charging you, as my boss likes to say, for the box of tissues in the room and the Advil and the IV and everything that goes along with it. So this is also how other payers and government payers are moving, and we're hoping to start to move our system to away from a fee-for-service into paying for value. Number nine, we'll ask for stakeholder involvement in setting annual targets for quality and cost effectiveness. And number 10 is to reduce travel costs by requiring recipients to obtain medical service in their recipient's home community to the extent appropriate and when services are actually available in their home community. And we're hoping that telehealth will help keep folks at home. And again, as my boss said in the introduction, better coordination with travel overall. So that way, if it's non-emergent care, we can really coordinate and make sure they're getting the biggest bang for their buck when they're traveling. And number 11 is guidelines for healthcare providers to develop healthcare delivery models supported by evidence-based practices that encourage wellness and disease prevention. That specific provision came from the Governor's Senate Bill 78. They put it under duties of the commissioner, and we moved it into the reform program. Subsection B starts on page 26, line 18. This is about behavioral health. We did not want to do a whole Medicaid reform bill and leave behavioral health out in the dust. So we worked with Jeff Jesse of the Alaska Mental Health Trust to really make sure we were putting in a program that would address the appropriate behavioral health needs of our state. So subsection B requires the department to efficiently manage a comprehensive and integrated behavioral health system that uses evidence-based practices that are data-driven with measurable outcomes. And the department and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority must provide a plan for a continuum of care for community-based services that includes housing, employment, and criminal justice issues. And I'd just like to point out that on lines 22 through 25, in there it says, the goal of the program is to assist recipients of services under the program to recover by achieving the highest level of autonomy with the least dependence on state-funded service possible for each person. So we're really putting out that our intent is that, you know, they're going to be self-sustaining as possible. Subsection C starts on page 27, line 2. That has the department identify areas of the state where improvements to access in telehealth or telemedicine would be most effective in reducing the cost of Medicaid. and it would allow the department to enter into agreements with Indian Health Service providers if necessary to improve access to telemedicine facilities and equipment. Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has been leading the way on telemedicine across the state, so we are hoping to partner and learn from them instead of just reinventing the wheel. Subsection D starts on page 27, line 9. This is one of the reports to the legislature, and it will have the Department of Health and Social Services annually report to the legislature on November 15th. That date is purposely before the start of session each year. And this is a department that I like to think of, or a report that will be very useful to the House and Senate Finance Committees and the Health and Social Services Committees. It is will no longer be optional to ignore Medicaid for 20 years as a legislature. So you're going to have a report every year that's going to tell you about the reforms that are working, growth in the program, savings from reforms, a statement whether the department has met annual targets for quality and cost effectiveness, recommendations for the legislature, including legislative changes, budget changes, impacts of federal law, if there are legal and technological barriers to the expanded use of telehealth, and so on and so forth. So we really want them to tell us, what do we need to know while you guys are putting together the budget, and what do we need to change? And the last subsection is E. It starts on page 28, line 13, and that provides a definition for telehealth. Section 29 is on page 28, line 18, through page 29, line 8. This is a primary care case management program. This was taken from the governor's Senate Bill 78, and we amended it in Senate Finance. So this requires the department to implement the primary care case management system. The purpose of the system is to increase Medicaid enrollees' appropriate use of primary and preventative care while decreasing the use of specialty care and hospital emergency department services. And there is an exemption for recipients with chronic, acute, or terminal medical conditions. So, for instance, we had a specific conversation about those who are receiving hospice care and that they would not need to be assigned a primary care case manager.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on that section, so is this going to be mandated for the primary care case management for enrollees, or is this optional?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, on page 28, line 19, we put in there that the department shall establish. It does say an optional service, but we take away that may, and I believe the intent of the department is to implement it as widespread as possible.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
My question was really more with the recipient, not the department. So I enroll in Medicaid. Am I going to then be put in that I have to have this portion of it, or will I have the option to participate or not to?
Through the chair, Rep. Wilson, it's our intent that, yes, you will be assigned as a Medicaid recipient a primary care provider. We're more focused on that primary care provider piece. So I believe I want to say a tentative yes, but I want to take that question and do some more digging to make sure I get you the proper answer.
I'd appreciate that.
Continue.
Section 30 is on page 29, line 9, and this is a section about waivers. This came from the governor's Senate Bill 78. And subsection D allows the department to apply for the 1915I option in home and community-based services. So that is currently funded purely by 100% general fund services for folks that are receiving grants in senior and disability services for things like Alzheimer's. And this would move it to a 50-50 state-federal match. Number two allows the department to apply for the 1915K option, and this is a refinancing of our state senior and disability services who are currently on the 15C waiver, and that will actually give us an enhanced FMAP, and it'll move us from a 50% to a 56% FMAP. Number three is a 1945 option for health homes and individuals with chronic conditions. So this is really primary care case management to the max. So these are folks who have very chronic conditions, often have behavioral health issues as well as primary care issues. And the incentive here is that for the first 8 quarters, the federal match for services is a 90% FMAP. Subsection E directs the department to apply for an 1115 waiver to establish one or more demonstration projects focused on innovative payment models. Just simply because I know we'll have a day on waivers, an 1115 just asks us to bend the rules on what we currently have in our state plan. So we ask CMS, hey, if we show budget neutrality, can we do all of these innovative things with our Medicaid program? And subsection F directs the department to apply for an 1115 waiver specific to behavioral health. And some of these items that we've put in here with behavioral health are specific to address some of the barriers that have come up over the years by our fragmented behavioral health system. So one of the things that was talked about extensively in the Senate Finance Committee is we have this 30% rule that if you have a behavioral health clinic, you have to have psychiatric oversight by a psychiatrist 30% of the time they're on staff in person. And that's a pretty big burden. And we have some providers that we feel like could do that without being a licensed psychiatrist. So some of these items will open up regulations. That 30% rule was a regulation, so we didn't feel the need to change it because it will be opened up by some of these provisions. Moving on to Section 31, this is on page 30, line 18, through page 31, line 15, is specific to our collaborative hospital-based project to reduce the use of emergency department services. Again, this project and the next one in Section 31 are projects that we hope are going to move us away from fee-for-service. So this project would build on what the department has already done with their super utilizer program. It's modeled on a successful project in Washington State, and it's about directing individuals to the right care at the right time in the right place. So number four, specifically, I want to point out on page 31, line 3, it sets out a process for referring an ER user to a primary care provider or a behavioral health provider within 96 hours after an ER visit. And I should back up a minute. This project was original to Senate Bill 74. We amended it in committee, and this was also a recommendation that came out of the Medicaid redesign process from the department's consultants, Agnew Beck. And so this project will actually be in partnership with a state professional hospital association, and they will be the ones taking the lead on the project. And the other provision I wanted to point out is number 5, which is on line 7 of page 31, and that will provide for a collaborative process between the department and the statewide professional hospital association to establish uniform statewide guidelines for prescribing narcotics in an emergency department. We've had a lot of testimony and a lot of conversation that our state has a pretty big opioid problem. That was why we put in the provisions earlier around the prescription drug monitoring program, and that's also why that number is listed here in the CR project. The rest of Section 31 is about coordinated care demonstration projects, and that starts on page 31, line 16. These projects are about the whole person in integrated care with payment models that move us, again, away from fee-for-service and towards paying for value. So in the Senate Finance Committee and in our Medicaid Reform Subcommittee, we had a lot of conversations around the acronym SOUPs of options, including managed care organizations, accountable care organizations, coordinated care organizations, and so on and so forth. And we came up with this project as a way to bring forward the best projects and the best proposals for the state of Alaska. So on page 32, line 16, subsection A requires the department to solicit and contract with one or more third-party entities for these demonstration projects for individuals who are Medicaid beneficiaries, and this will start on or before December 31st, 2016. The department can use an innovative procurement process for this, and a proposal for consideration must include three or more of the following 8 items. It must include a comprehensive primary care-based management, including behavioral health services and coordination of long-term services and support. Care coordination, including the assignment of a primary care provider located in the goal geographic area of the recipient. Health promotion, that can include things like checking vitamin D levels and if you're taking other proper vitamins and so on and so forth. Number four is comprehensive transitional care and follow-up care after inpatient treatment. Number five is referral to community and social support services, including career and educational training services. Number six is sustainability and the ability to replicate in other regions of the state. We put that in there purposely. We want projects that we can actually launch on a wider level after they prove out. Number seven is integration and coordination of benefits, services, and utilization management. And eight is local accountability for health and resource allocation. So these projects will then be submitted to, under subsection B, a project review committee, and that's on page 32, line 17. That review committee will review and decide which projects get to be launched, and that's comprised of the Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, the Commissioner of Administration, the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, two representatives of stakeholder groups appointed by the governor for staggered three-year terms, and then a non-voting member of the Senate appointed by the Senate President and a non-voting member of the House appointed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives. So under subsection C, which is on page 33, line 1, this grants the department the authority to contract with the actual third parties to implement these demonstration projects. And those can include managed care organizations, primary care case managers, accountable care organizations, prepaid ambulatory health plans, or a provider-led entity. And this would allow for fee structures, including but not limited to, again, those innovative structures like global payments, bundled payments, capitated payments, and shared savings and risks. And this does require the department to work with the Division of Insurance to streamline the application process for a company to obtain a certificate of authority if they need to participate in a demonstration project. Subsection D is on page 33, lines 10, and that requires any project to also include cost-saving measures, including the expanded use of telehealth for primary care, urgent care, and behavioral health. And subsection E is where we're going to test out and see if these projects true up. So on page 33, line 17, it requires the department to contract with a third-party actuarial to review these projects for any project that has been in place for 1 year or more. So on or before December 31st, 2018, and each year thereafter, the actuary will submit a final report to the department for any project that has been in operation for at least a year. Subsection F then has the department prepare a plan regarding regional or statewide implementation of a coordinated care project, and they will submit that on November 15th, 2019, and each year thereafter to the legislature on projects that they feel should be launched on a wider regional or statewide basis. Subsection G refers to the previous definition of telehealth. And this project will continue on, so if the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare in a few years come up with a new demonstration project or some other innovative method, the department can just run these projects through the same project review committee and use the same process. Okay, section 32 on page 34, line 5, requires the department and the attorney general to annually prepare a report regarding fraud prevention, abuse, prosecution, and vulnerabilities in the Medicaid program. Section 33 is on page 35, line 2, and this removes the grantee requirement status for outpatient community mental health clinics serving Medicaid patients. Section 34 on page 35, line 7, again, does the same thing, but from drug and alcohol treatment centers as well as outpatient community mental health clinics. This change in the one in the previous section allows mental health and drug and treatment service providers who do not currently receive grants from the Division of Behavioral Health to become enrolled Medicaid providers and deliver services to Medicaid recipients. An important thing to note about these provisions, this will align us with requirements by the federal government to provide these services. The federal government told us we have to remove these grantee requirements or they will start withholding behavioral health Medicaid funds. And again, this will help address our shortage of behavioral health providers across the state. And section 35 is on page 35, line 15. It is about the Alaska Pioneer Home Payment Assistance, and it requires individuals who are applying for Pioneer Home Medicaid or Pioneer Home Payment Assistance to first show proof of having applied for Medicaid. And this came out of the HB 30 audits. It was an amendment that was added in Senate Finance, and this will actually save the state $1 million a year by having this provision in there. And I apologize, Sections 33 and 34, to be consistent, did come from the Governor's Senate Bill 78.
For the record, this is Stacey Crayley again. Section 36 and 37 again relate back to the Medicaid False Claims and Reporting Act. Section 36, as I testified earlier, there's a three-year sunset. Section 36 are the repealer provisions for the private plaintiff, relator, individual. Those are the repeals for the sunset provisions. Section 37 are the indirect and direct court rule amendments that need to take place as a result of the creation of this new cause of action. And those go on the bottom of page 35, starting on line 28, through basically the entire next page, 36. There's quite a few court rule amendments that take place. I can walk through those, or you can ask questions about them.
Perhaps at a later time.
That's what I assumed. I didn't think you wanted that.
Again, for the record, Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Kelly. Section 38 is the implementation of the federal policy on tribal Medicaid reimbursement. I know as a finance committee, you had a lot of discussion around the rule change that the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare put out about services being received through an IHS or a tribal facility and those being reimbursed 100%. So this section asks that the department fully implement that within 6 months of the rule being finalized and to submit a report to the co-chairs of the House and Senate Finance Committee on the savings. Section 39 came from the Governor's Senate Bill 78, and this is a health information infrastructure plan. It's on page 39, line 20. This is one result of the Medicaid redesign process the department has undertaken, and it requires the department to develop a plan to strengthen the health information infrastructure, including health data analytics capability to support the transformation of the health systems in Alaska. We have a long way to go to improve our data analytics, and the department is determined to implement this correctly and aggressively. Section 40, our feasibility studies. This was original to Senate Bill 74, and we have expanded on it. So those are on page 38, line 4. As you're probably aware, feasibility studies are required before any service that is done in a state facility can be privatized. So subsection A addresses the Alaska Pioneer Homes and Select Division of Juvenile Justice Facilities. This study will be procured by the Department of Health and Social Services. And we certainly don't expect these studies to look at the same structure or the same result for each service or even each select DJJ facility. What they might find will work in Nome certainly won't work in Ketchikan or work in Anchorage, so they will have the authority to kind of look at those best practices for those 24/7 facilities. Subsection B is looking at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and this will be done with the department in conjunction with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And there are a lot of private psychiatric hospitals in other states, and you can certainly just do a Google search on the problems that API has had, and it's pretty extensive. Subsection C is the healthcare authority that Senator Kelly alluded to in his opening. That is on line 22. And this requires the Department of Administration, in collaboration with the House and Senate Finance Committees, to conduct a study analyzing the feasibility of creating a healthcare authority to coordinate healthcare plans and consolidate purchasing effectiveness for all state employees, retired state employees, retired teachers, Medicaid assistance recipients, University of Alaska employees, employees of state corporations, and school district employees. So other states like Washington State and Oregon State have used healthcare authorities very effectively, and they've leveraged all of the healthcare that their state is paying for. As you're aware, when you looked at the contracts this year with state employees, the cost of healthcare continues to rise in Alaska, and we cannot stay on this trajectory without making
big drastic change. So this is just one tool to study how do we pool all of these, leverage our purchasing effectiveness, and hopefully bend the curve and maybe even bend the curve of cost of healthcare in Alaska. Section 41, which is on page 39, line 17, it requires the department to amend the state Medicaid plan and apply for any waivers necessary to implement the projects and programs described in the bill. Section 22 allows for transition regulations. That's on page 39, line 28. Section 43 are conditional effects on page 40, line 7. And these conditional effects just...
You want to just slow down.
Sorry. That's not a...
That's a great job.
Through the chair, Rep. Sadler, I apologize. That's that East Coast in me coming out. So the conditional effects just protect the department from having to follow a law in the books if the federal government won't actually approve a state plan amendments or waivers needed to implement the law. And subsection E on line 27 is specific to the provisions of the False Claims Act that are amending court rules and specifically require a two-thirds vote of the legislature. So sections 44 through 47, starting on page 41 on line 1, provide for effective dates for the provisions that require waiver and state plan amendment approvals from the department, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Section 48 are immediate effective dates for sections 40, 41, 42A, and 43. Section 49 are effective dates that are July 1st, 2017, for sections 13 through 19 that relate to the prescription drug monitoring program. And then section 50 is an effective date of July 1, 2016 for 42B. And the final section, 51 on line 17, provides for a delayed effective date of July 1st, 2019 for sections 11 and 12 to conform to the sunset provisions around the private plaintiff items in the False Claims Act.
Wow. That was a lot to absorb. I'm seeing eyes that are kind of like glazing occasionally, but it's going to take people a little while to absorb all this. Mm-hmm. Representative Sadler.
Just really for the record, I believe she misstated the effective date of Section 49. She said it was July 1st. It's actually on Section 49 takes effect January 1st, 17.
Yep. Through the chair, I happily stand corrected.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the telemedicine, because there's a lot of telemedicine, telehealth in here, do we already allow the telemedicine, telehealth within our own insurance? So are we just following our insurance and now putting Medicaid in with that?
Through the chair, Rep. Wilson, I'm not sure what our state insurance currently allows. I know there are health plans offered by private companies in the state that want to use telehealth options, but the in-state requirement has limited that use.
Follow up.
Representative Wilson.
And you can get this back to me, but, you know, it just seems like that's the way we're heading, and I have no problem with that whatsoever. I just, you know, if this is a great idea here, I think it's a great idea for our private insurance as well as just for the whole state. I just don't know why we would just make it Medicaid only. And I just I honestly don't know whether we already do. And I just had one other question, and also you can get back.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I know it's in here, one of the discussions we've been having in House Finance is about all the different optional benefits. I'd like to know whether or not that's been discussed, because there's none of those in here on reviewing those and seeing whether this is the time that we don't give all those optional benefits at this point. So I'd like to know whether it was discussed. If so, and it'd probably be better in writing, and if so, why they're not in here.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Rep. Wilson, just to address quickly, the provisions about telehealth and telemedicine are specific to the use across the state. It is not specific to the Medicaid program. And just because I was going to answer Rep. Sadler's earlier question about optional benefits, it was something that was brought up in committee as well as privately. And we looked at the optional benefits, and they are actually money savers for the state. So specifically, we had Ledge Research update a report, and I'd be happy to share that with you, on specific to primary care attendance and home and community-based services. And they save the state of Alaska a lot of money. And the problem with that is that all of those individuals who are receiving care meet an institutional level of care. So if they weren't receiving care at home, we'd have to care for them in institutions. And that means we would have to put in money in our capital budget we don't have to build nursing homes and others. And we, some of the things that are on optional benefits include pharmacy, hospital ER use, and so on. So those actually show up as costs elsewhere if we don't provide those. But I can certainly provide the research piece for you.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, that's Chairman.
For committee people, please, we have other people that are available to answer questions. We have Commissioner Valerie Davidson in the room. We have Deputy Commissioner John Sherwood in the room. We have Deputy Commissioner Karen Forrest in the room. We have Dr. Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer, on the phone. Randall Burns, Director, Division of Behavioral Health by phone. Dwayne Mays, Director of Division of Senior and Disability Services on the phone. Sean O'Brien, Director, Division of Public Assistance is in the room. Margaret Brody, Director, Division of Health Care Services by phone. And Jared Coulson, Director, Office Rate Review by phone also. Available for questions. Representative Newman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And many of you are aware of concerns that I have with the prescription drug data monitoring database. And I asked the chair if I could share just a few moments with the committee some of my concerns in case they want to follow up on some of the questions and concerns that I have. Hopefully they'll learn more about it. Mr. Chair, I first got into this discussion when I took over the Budget Finance Subcommittee Chair for the Health and Social Services. And one of the things that first got my attention was that I asked, where is this $40 million in rebates that we got for the Department of Health and Social Services come from? And I come to find out just not only the Department of Health and Social Services had about that much, and it's generally been around that range, I believe, but Department of Administration also had received around $20 million back in rebates from pharmaceutical companies. So I was wondering what is going on with this? Well, there's a federal regulation that allows, and this is to the best of my understanding, and I'll make sure all members get all this information. It's my understanding that there's a federal regulation that allows, I guess, pharmaceutical companies to charge more for what the actual costs are for the prescription drugs that Alaskans get under the guise that these pharmaceutical companies get this, and this money comes back to the state of Alaska under, I guess, the guise of covering the cost of prescription drug for Medicaid patients, which is about $1 million a week. So it is fairly expensive. But to me, it seemed very wrong on how it proceeded forward, and the more I dug into it. Currently, when I go out and I talk to Alaskans and I ask them if they were aware that the state of Alaska keeps a database on all the prescription drugs that they, all the controlled prescription drugs that they present to the pharmacy, they look at me in quite a bit of an amazement because they were not aware of this, and they're certainly not very comfortable with it, probably for a lot of the same reasons that I am not very comfortable with it. We're very aware that databases within the state of Alaska get hacked. This is not uncommon. This, and they're supposed to provide for the best security they can, but there's some pretty bright individuals out there. And then I think to myself, what could happen to access the information like this? And again, it raises some more very serious concerns for me. There could be drug gangs out there who would love to have that. And why is it a concern? And I'll probably just start at the beginning. When somebody brings in a prescription that the pharmacist or maybe a pharmacy tech feels is an inappropriate or an illegal script, they're required to destroy those scripts and, you know, or at least not give the script back. Now, there is no enforcement behind this except for people like my wife, who's a pharmacy tech, or that pharmacist to go and either not return or destroy that script. And I'm very concerned about retribution from drug addicts in the state of Alaska who have a script that could be worth thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars. They're not getting that back. And so now we've got just hardworking Alaskans who are in the enforcement arm of this. That's a huge concern of mine, is the retribution on that. Maybe not people might not be as nice as my wife or other pharmacy techs. This bill actually allows more expansion to access to this database. Those people could certainly give that information, your information, to people who maybe are not quite the upstanding Alaskans that we like to think about. Several years ago, there was some seniors in Big Lake who were robbed of their prescription drugs, and I believe they were murdered. This would allow this, and when I ask Alaskans, and fill in a name, Representative Wilson, or Representative Miller, I'll just say some other name. Do you feel comfortable knowing that somebody could give access to your personal information? Say you broke a leg, and the doctor gives you a prescription for 100 Percocet to deal with the pain. That they can give that information to maybe not such upstanding Alaskans and say, oh, by the way, so-and-so just filled a prescription for 100 Percocet, and here's their address. And when I tell my constituents that, they look at me in amazement and go, wow, that does not make me feel very comfortable. I get it. I've worked as hard on drug and alcohol abuses in this state as anybody. 3 years ago, I put intent language, and people say intent language doesn't matter. Well, it did in this case. I put intent language in the operating budget that allowed for the recidivism reduction group to form. I brought different groups together, and we wrote the recidivism reduction plan, which is the basis for a lot of reform for substance abuse treatments in this state. A plan we worked hard on, and I'm proud of. The House took action this year to address that issue, and I'm not going to go into that, Mr. Speaker, but I'm going to stay on the database. So now I get to looking back at this further, and we also provide to doctors a preferred drug list. I have been around this business long enough to know, or at least suspect, that maybe drugs on that preferred drug list are ones that the state might get the biggest rebate from. So now I believe there's an opportunity for the state to stick their nose in between the doctor and their patient based on how much money the state gets back on rebates. And if it doesn't happen, it certainly could. I have no proof that it is, but again, I know how hard these people are trying to find money in this state to try and support their budgets. And I bring this up because I do have such concerns for opioid overdose. And there is a movement to try and deal with this. I talked to one of our local doctors in Wasilla who had issues because he was losing patients. Because the states of Washington and California, I believe, require that doctors or, most of us generally have a family doctor that we use. What do we call them? Primary care providers in the terms that we use, that we've been going to for years, that know your family history, that know your history. And these doctors should be talking to their patients about the effects of opioids or any drugs that they take. What are the benefits, but what are the risks that you take to your health? And that should be a conversation that patients should have with their primary care providers. But now these doctors aren't even allowed to talk to their patients that they've been seeing for 20, 30 years. Their patients are now being told you have to go to a specialty doctor that provides for long-term cares. So now they have a different primary care provider. I guess it's not their primary care provider. It's the one that is there that dispenses their pain medications or arthritis or whatever issues they have, any classified drug, which is just about all of them. The cost of those clinics for an office visit is upward of $550 a visit. So how many of these Medicaid or Medicare patients is this causing the state's budget to go up? As opposed to going to their primary care provider that could have been up for 10, 20, 30 years, that know their history, that know their medical conditions, that might cost $150. What about doctors now that will have to join this, or they get their DEA license pulled, their ability to prescribe drugs if they don't feel that this is appropriate, but most of them put in their office visits for about 15 minutes, about four an hour. Now they're going to have to try and expand to this. Most of us know when we go to our family doctor, he doesn't go into his back office, look at a prescription drug database, and come back and do this. In fact, I have talked to several people that work in specialty clinics for medications for prescription drugs who say they do not use this database. And I said, well, why? It saves lives is what we hear. And it's my understanding, and I don't have access to this database, but it's my understanding, and this is what I was told by several doctors, that there's seven pages that are printed up of federal regulations. They have to print those out and sign each one that says that they completely understand that information. They've read it all, and they completely understand it, each page. The doctors that I talked to about this have said, there's no way I'm going to sign anything like that. They didn't understand how anybody could understand seven pages of federal regulations and sign under the, if they are found that they didn't do that, that they will lose their DEA license, their ability to write scripts. And the doctor said, I'm not going to lose my ability to write scripts because there's no way. I don't think a doctor could sit and say, I've read and understand all these regulations. They just don't use it. I get it. I can see you in an emergency room when somebody comes into the doctor's, in the emergency room, and they're lying in an emergency room and they need a treatment. And those doctors trying to figure out maybe what scripts are on. Maybe there's an opportunity there to get access to it under that instance. But generally, emergency rooms are there for triage. They're there to get you through the weekend. They're there to make sure you get to your primary care provider, the doctor that's been your doctor for years who knows your medical history. They're not light writing scripts that are for large amounts. Usually very, very strict on what they do write. So I have huge concerns about the state of Alaska keeping a database in what I feel, and it's me and it's my feel after looking at this very hard for years. I've talked to our federal delegation about this, about federal regulations that allow this to happen. Upwards of $60 million in rebates that the state gets, let alone, I don't know what the pharmaceutical companies get for their administrative fees, but I suspect they probably get as much as they can. So in Alaska, we're spending at least $60 million a year extra money paid by Alaskans for their prescription drugs that comes back in rebates for the state of Alaska. To me, this is probably what I consider the largest, biggest crime in America today, where our state of Alaska voluntarily enters into a program with the federal government. And by the way, yes, the federal government has access to these records too. That allows them to go back and give this money back to the state of Alaska because the state of Alaska would rather have it as an increment in their operating budget to cover their costs. Yeah, I think we need to look at this. I think we need to look at it pretty seriously, Mr. Co-Chair and other members, because I think there's some real issues here, and I can expand on it further if members would like to talk to me. But I want to make sure that the public is aware of my concerns and what I've been able to find out about this, because I think they would be very concerned also. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to remind everybody, we are going to be taking each one of these topics and having a separate meeting on them. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll be getting the lineup to the committee members, so you'll know when we're going to be talking about fraud, when we're going to be talking about pharmaceuticals, when we're going to be talking about telemedicine. So you'll have an idea of when we're going to be bringing that up as the topic for that meeting. And we're going to be having a lot of meetings on Senate Bill 74 over the next 2 weeks. Next up, we have Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for reiterating we will hear these in more depth. I just have a very brief question regarding sections 1 through 7 and telehealth. In each of the sections 1 through 7, it specifically prohibits the state medical board from imposing sanctions for rendering a diagnosis. So I guess my question has to deal with liability of a physician if they do something wrong, and whether does that mean now that the state board has no ability to sanction them if they've done something in a criminal act?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, just to clarify, each of these sections are related to their specific board and who they oversee. Okay, so right. Only three of them are specific to the state medical board. But no, the how it's worded, it just means that they cannot impose sanctions for purely using telehealth. So they can still regulate bad medical behavior, bad practice. They just cannot go after a doctor for simply doing that via telehealth.
Perfect, thank you. And then second.
Follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
Okay, thank you. And then part of the discussion was so that we don't prevent, or so that we prevent having sort of a doc in the box from physicians outside of state that become licensed. So under this current, if these sections 1 through 7 were adopted, could physicians, psychologists, social workers be licensed, be out of state, but be licensed within the state to practice, and then be able to practice via telehealth?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the only board we specifically call out that in-state, out-of-state provision is the state medical board. That's the one that has not allowed individuals to perform telehealth via out-of-state. The other boards currently don't have in their provisions whether they allow telehealth or not, so this allows them to have telehealth, but we leave the decision of whether those individuals will be in-state or out-of-state up to the boards.
Great. And then follow-up?
Representative Kawasaki.
And then just along that same line, worried, it seems like physicians, if we want to try and hire a physician in some place like Anchorage, it's fairly easy because it's large, it's larger. They can pay competitive wages, and I guess I'd worry if say a smaller town wanted to hire somebody but could get it done cheaper by having sort of this telehealth bridge. And so I wonder if you could speak to that in terms of how it would become in the future, it might become difficult to recruit, say, and or whether that was discussed in the other body.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I know some of the conversations are around this. These provisions are bringing the rest of the state up in line with what's already being done within Indian Health Services. So, like I said, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and those IHS providers are extensively using telehealth. They currently can have providers do this from out of state. So we're trying to true up and allow the same availability for everyone else. There are communities where you're never going to get a doctor to live out there. We certainly see that. So that this is something that telehealth can help address. However, you're still going to have individuals that are going to need hands-on primary care. So we don't see telehealth completely eliminating that need. I certainly know that me as a younger generation with my eye devices are probably going to use a telehealth option, especially if our state insurance will allow me to. Somebody like my mom who's in her 50s is not going to be comfortable using that. So I don't see telehealth completely taking away hands-on primary care. I cannot answer if we specifically talked about the cost and this is going to drive providers out, but I will follow up with who that initial bill sponsor was and have them get back to your office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then follow-up.
Representative Kawasaki.
Section 28 deals with civil asset forfeiture. I guess this is more of a legal question, but is this the typical way civil asset forfeitures are done in non-medical fraud cases? That's page 23 in the bills where it starts to talk about civil penalties and civil asset forfeitures.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, can you repeat your question?
My question was around the idea that is this the way that civil asset forfeitures are done in other, maybe not even fraud, but just in other cases within the state?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, you're talking about the seizure and forfeiture of real and personal property.
Yes.
The answer to that question is yes and no. There are very, we don't really have a civil forfeiture provision within the state of Alaska, aside from what is currently used with fish and game. So when we were drafting this, look at those provisions. These sections come from other states who have a more robust civil forfeiture provision for broader schemes. But so it's a little bit of both. We do some civil forfeiture for fish and game violations, and so some of that is incorporated within here, but the template for this provision was broader than just Alaska.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just reading the plain view in the sectional and in the bill itself on page 23, it talks about what real property could be subject to this seizure, including bank accounts. That kind of makes sense. An inventory dealing specifically with the fraud itself, mm-hmm. that kind of makes sense. But then it lists a bunch of other things specifically in the bill, including automobiles, boats, airplanes, stocks and bonds.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, part of the reason why that is as broad as it is it's born out of experience, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow when we present on the fraud and false claims provisions. But the Medicaid Fraud Unit has had some difficulty in recovering. People get charged with crimes, and they transfer their assets, cars, houses, boats, planes, and they're nowhere to be found at the point of recovery. So some of that is born out of a personal experience, and the Medicaid Fraud Control Director, Andrew Peterson, can speak more directly to that tomorrow.
Okay, great. Thank you.
As you heard, we're going to be having fraud tomorrow. So.
That's what I was told.
Yes, we are. Okay. You'll be having a list come to your members as to when we're going to address which topics, so you'll know that you don't need to ask the question possibly, you know, tomorrow, but 3 days from now when we have the next time that we have that topic up. Representative Sadler, followed by Representative Gaddis, followed by Representative Guerra. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, Ms. Haddock, thank you for an exhaustive and detailed and very, very professionally presented overview. I appreciate that very much so. And I'm again, glad we're going to take this up by functional sections. That'll be one way to scope down a big bill. There was reference to a report, I think it was, that the department had done. And I was rapidly searching through my notes here, and I couldn't find my double stars. That means it's very important. But you had referenced a report, and I just would like to make sure you get that to us. I'm not sure if that was something the department had done or if it was an assessment of the Agnew-Beck report.
Through the chair, Rep. Sadler, the one report that I mentioned was about the cost of optional services for our primary care and home and community-based services, and I will submit that to the chair for distribution.
Great. Thank you.
Hello. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And I've got one specific question, then a general question, and I'll look forward to more detailed questions later. On page 9 of the sectional analysis, you make reference in, 4705270B. You're directing the department to work with the Mental Health Trust for a behavioral health, community-based services, and that's good. They are professionals at that. Right below that, in section subparagraph C, you ask the department to identify areas where telehealth improvement would be effective to reduce Medicaid costs. And you said that ANTH, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, are the pros from Dover there, but you don't have the department work with ANTHC. Why is that?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, specifically in the bill, it says on lines 7 and 8 that the department may enter into agreements with Indian health service providers, so that would be the more appropriate name and statute for a group like Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
Bingo, thank you. And my general question, I'm going to
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will defer more detailed questions, but can you characterize the involvement that the subcommittee in Senate Finance had with stakeholders in developing this bill? I've read the Agnew-Beck report and seen their extensive list of people they consulted with and stakeholders they talked to. So can you give us some idea that who you talked to and what the nature of their involvement was, and if there's anybody that you left out or has come to you complaining about being left out?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we heard from a lot of folks as we were creating each section. We did hear testimony from Agnew-Beck as the department's contractors, as well as the Menzies Group, the legislature's contractors. We heard a lot of feedback from Becky Holberg and the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association.
Jeff Jesse with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. We heard from Tom Chard with the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, Kate Burkhart with our Alaska Mental Health Board, and the Alcohol Advisory Board on Alcohol and Drug Abuse. We heard the Dental Society was tracking it and provided feedback. The Primary Care Association provided feedback. The Psychological Association provided feedback. The Primary Care Association with Nancy Merriman was there and testified, as well as several providers like South Central Foundation. I can certainly get you the whole list of folks we heard from, but it was exhaustive and extensive, and if somebody reached out to us, we offered to hear from them, as well as Aaron Schein, who is staff to Senator McKinnon, and myself worked one-on-one with as many as possible.
One more representative, Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. I would love to see that list. If you've got contact information, that would be very helpful. And one more thing that would be helpful is there's a number of places in the bill that demand that require reports to the legislature of various dates on various topics. If you by chance have a table or a just a digest or extract of those different reports, what they're required, who gives them, and when they're due, I'd appreciate having that kind of just a distillation of those reports.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, and working with the co-chair staff, I've been asked to create kind of just a master table that lists the big topics and the provisions in the bill, and I can certainly make sure the report section lists which type of reports, and they're all due on the same date, so that's a little helpful, but I will make sure that's included in that document.
I'm impressed with the presentation. Thank you.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I ran a bill on telehealth a couple years ago, and this bill tweaked some of the things that we just didn't think we could do a couple years ago, recognizing that we all have cell phones and we all use technology, bringing us into the technological century. That being said, I wanted to ask a couple questions just to be sure. When I ran my bill, it's one of the things that I became aware of is the Indian Health or the Indian Health Service actually has a federal exemption that keeps them from being sanctioned. And what I think this bill is doing is it allows everybody else outside of that from being sanctioned by the medical board as well. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, that is correct.
Okay. And then, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I'm going to speak to my colleague across the way there. Just in regards to, is telehealth offered to at least the state of Alaska employees? And yes, it is. The unfortunate part, again, I'm actually speaking to all of us, that it is offered to all of us. Unfortunately, we can't use it because we don't have the doctors. Because we passed a bill that only they had to not only be licensed by Alaska, but reside in Alaska. And so we're not able to utilize that technology that one could use by using folks from elsewhere that are licensed in Alaska. So we do in our insurance, if you'll note, it shows Teladoc is an option, but we can't use it because they were unable to get people here in Alaska. So we're not really using technology in the manner we could. So I think that we've moved along in this bill and we're opening up that opportunity. So I thank those for putting it in. Thank you.
Representative Gaddis. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to be really hard for me to say in committee, but that was a really good presentation by a Yankees fan. Though you still have time to reform. there's a statement in the sponsor statement. No, actually, it really was Ms. Shattuck, so it was impressive for a Yankees fan. On the in the sponsor statement, it has a line. The first line in the third paragraph says Alaska has some of the highest Medicaid rates in the nation and has not employed many of the rate innovations of other states or those of Medicare. And I didn't hear anything as we went through the bill that touched on that, but here's my concern, and tell me what you can say to allay that concern, or maybe this is for another day, but what we hear is from many providers is that Medicaid reimbursement rates are often not high enough to attract physicians, and they've been frustrated at them. But certainly Medicare rates have been particularly troubling for physicians, and a lot of physicians don't even take Medicare. So is there a provision of this bill that's going to lower rates, lower Medicaid rates to more reflect the rates paid by Medicare? That would cause me concerns about patient access.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, in the Medicaid reform provisions where I talked about redesigning the payment process, that was number 8. We had a lot of conversation about rates, and we sent questions back and forth in the subcommittee to the commissioner saying, you know, why are rates not adequate? Why are they not in line with Medicare? Are providers not taking Medicaid because of the rates? So we went back and forth, but we also realized that rate setting is kind of an art form in itself. So we're trying to move the whole system away from fee-for-service. So in order to do that, we put in here the redesigning the payment process to include some of those innovative rates. That's also the whole intention behind the coordinated care projects, is to start to see what kind of innovative rate structures and care coordination will work on a global basis. So there's a fiscal note from the Office of Rate Review that actually talks about how they're going to implement those two sections. And, you know, setting rates requires us to use an actuarial analysis in this extensive process. As you know, it requires those to go out in front of the actual providers for public comment. So it's really hard in this bill to mess with that entire process and set in here saying these are our new rates, because there does require a process. And we are trying to move the entire system off from fee-for-service. That's also why we didn't address some of the things like copays, because we've heard from providers that really they end up eating that cost. And there are provisions that are set by the federal government about what you can actually charge for copays. And I'm not the expert on that. That would definitely be Margaret Brody. So I'm just going to say she's prepared, has kind of some information that she can share down the road on that. But, again, we're trying to move the whole system. So adding in things like copays and that when you're trying to move our structure away from fee-for-service can be counterintuitive as well. And our technology may not even work. It may cost more to collect a very nominal amount in those kind of fees.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, and I agree on copays. We've heard from former Commissioner Struer that as much as we'd like to get copays, sometimes they're much more expensive to collect than they are for them. That gets outweighed by the money. That outweighs the money that we receive from copays, so I understand that. And I'll just let those who testify in the later, I just want to make sure we don't do with this what they do in Medicare. For example, a primary care visit, a doctor gets $65. And the physicians have always told us that that's completely inadequate. So for them to want to serve the Medicare population, but they do out of a sense of obligation when they do. So I'll have some of those questions later on. There was discussion about reducing the cost for home and community-based care. And I know we have those who provide, like, respite care and personal care attendants, they already get paid a very low level right now. In reducing the cost for home and community-based care, are we going to put pressure to lower the pay for those folks any more than it already is? Do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the intention is not to go that direction, but to use innovative methods like telemedicine. Like, for instance, on home and community-based services, instead of having to send somebody out to their home every day, you could put something like an iPad in this person's home, you know, FaceTime in and say, hey, did you take your medication today? Did you do this and this? So we're really saying, look at these innovative items. Again, in section, I believe it was section 30, we refer to the waivers, and that's where we're asking the department to go ahead and implement the 1915I and 1915K option, as well as the 45 health homes. And those don't reduce the services, but help shift at what we're getting from the federal government. So,
thanks. And just finally, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah, and I think I'll probably leave this for the department, but I know they're moving ahead with a number of these waivers already. So I'm just not exactly sure why we need the bill, other than maybe the department wants to have the legislature's blessing that they're moving ahead. So I'll ask some of those questions later, but I think they're already moving ahead with a number of these cost-saving waivers.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I can answer that pretty authoritatively. Yes, that's exactly what they want. Deputy Commissioner Sherwood and I had that conversation that they want to make sure they do have legislative A-OK that they can go ahead and apply for those.
Thanks. All right.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left, and we have four more committee members with questions, so remember that timing. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try and be prudent. Our time on in your sectional analysis, section 23 is competitive bidding for durable medical equipment, and Representative Gaddis might know this. She's very good on this. But it talks about that the Medicaid services provider can go through a program that can be delivered on a statewide basis. Does this mean that only providers that work through a statewide basis can do this or enter into the contract with the states for the competitive bidding process, which actually by state procurement's been increased so they don't have to do as many competitive bids anymore. So does this make it so they have to be able to deliver statewide, or can it be done regionally?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, no, it can be done regionally. It's just that we're specific in the type of things we wanted to allow to be done like this, like durable medical equipment, wheelchairs, et cetera. Travel would be something on a statewide. We were approached about considering other things that we weren't comfortable with, but it was in no way to mean that one provider had to do this entirely statewide.
Just a couple of short questions, Mr. Chair. In Section 25, it amends state statute the number of programs to no less than 50 per year in the audits. I don't know how many they're doing now, but why would we say, department, you have to do a minimum? We don't even know the cost of that. Is adding more personnel, or why was that selected?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, we selected there's current statute that requires us to do 75, and there is a contract with an organization, Myers and Stauffer, that they do these audits for us, and we can get you a copy of that contract and how that's all reimbursed. We determined to reduce it to 50, or we're requesting permission to reduce it to 50 so that we can offset the cost of multiple audits. Providers have a lot of audits. When we first started these audits back in 2005, 2006, there were very few audits of Medicaid providers happening. Now they're audited at the federal level, at the local level, and when I say local, I mean insurance companies, the state of Alaska. And so we were thinking that along with the self-audit requirement, which I think is in Section 27, we would still get the same impact without having to do as many audits.
Mr. Chair, in Section 30, it talks about outlining cost containment. What's the current value of these current waivers? If the state accepted all the waivers that were out there that we currently know of, what is the value of that? And I see somewhere in here that you only have 6 months to be able to continue to apply, and I don't know why you'd want to put a time limit on that. But if we could get that information, Mr. Chair, from the department. And also, I would like to get a legal opinion on the authority for the department to develop regulations, impose fines, and set the amount of those fines. If we get a legal opinion on the authority for the department to do that, Mr. Chair.
We will do that.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Chairman, I think I will just pose my question another day, given the time limitations.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your work on this bill. I did a very good job presenting the information. So the Board of Pharmacy is the overseeing agency for the drug monitoring program. And the focus really is on the patient. I mean, trying to track patients who shop around or who have sought more than one prescription, possibly in a short period of time. There's a provision that the board would notify the pharmacist or practitioner. And have you contemplated how the database might be used to monitor the prescriptive practices of certain physicians who tend to overprescribe narcotics?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, since that was brought to my attention earlier today in a meeting with you, I have sent that question on to
to the director of Corporations Board and Licensing to try to get some feedback, as well as there's actually a prescription drug monitoring program technical assistance center in the United States. And I sent a feeler out to them, and they already responded. So when I get some feedback from them, I'm happy to share. But the other question could probably be addressed by the director when we have a day that focuses on the prescription drug monitoring program.
Okay, and if I could follow up on that.
Did
previous committees contemplate the State Board of Medicine being involved at all in the monitoring of prescriptive practices?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, currently, as just a board, if they're sanctioning somebody, they can't go in and use the database to look up that information. And actually, there are protections to allow that information not to be used incorrectly. There's actually provisions that are Class A misdemeanors and Class C felonies. So the board, they would have to, I mean, through a legal action, there can be a subpoena to look up information in there, but it's very restricted on who actually has access to that database. So right now, the method that the Senate chose was those unsolicited notifications to prescribers. So that, and with requiring the use, would just allow an education level to come up about who how much controlled substances prescribers are prescribing. So it's more on the educational side than a complete aggressive hammer, if that makes sense.
Okay. And then if I can follow up. And then on the types of drugs that are included, Schedule 2, 3, and 4, Schedule 2 and 3 being more addictive in nature, and Schedule 4 not as addictive or much less addictive. My concern is that the inclusion of Schedule 4 will create a great amount of workload on the part of the practitioners. And really, we're trying to get at the narcotics that are represented in Schedule 2 and 3. I'm wondering if that discussion came up in previous committees.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, we had a lot of discussion about what schedules to include. And Schedule 4 actually includes benzodiazepines. I probably said that wrong. Dr. Butler can clean that up for me later. And those can interact pretty badly with Schedule 2 and 3 drugs, and they actually do opposite things. We felt like it was important to have all of those in there. And just as a follow-up, the only folks that actually enter in the data in the database are the pharmacists or those folks at the pharmacy when the dispensing happens. And the day before this was passed on the floor of our Senate, the U.S. Senate passed Senate Bill 524, or the Comprehensive, I think it's Alcohol and Addiction and Drug Recovery Act. I probably have that wrong. It's the CARA Act. But that includes in Section 601 of that bill a use of a PDMP that would be required for prescribers and dispensers to look up Federal Schedule 2, 3, and 4 drugs. And the prescribers would have to look up all three before they actually prescribe. And this was something that was co-sponsored by both of our U.S. senators, or it was co-sponsored, sorry, by Senator Sullivan, but it was passed by both of our senators. So if that bill does become federal law, then the federal government would have a higher threshold. And those would be linked to federal grants and other things. And I realize that we don't want to take every federal grant out there, but that is one that would be linked to that requirement.
And thank you very much. And I just have one final question, Mr. Chairman.
One final question from Rick.
And this is for Stacey. I was interested in your presentation on the false claims, the new provision in the statute or the new section. Could a false claim be placed against the state of Alaska or one of our affiliates, either through, say, the Pioneer's Home or through the juvenile justice system? Or could it be applied in another way, such as underpayment or overpayment by the state, reimbursement of a payment, or not? I'm just
through the chair, Representative Munoz, I need to go back and look at it more closely. I will note that state agencies are subject to audit requirements, like the Pioneer Home. They do identify overpayments, and they have to reconcile those issues. So, as is, the Pioneer Home is subject to, license investigations and review like all other licensed assisted living homes. I do believe that there is a provision in here about state employees and as state agents in terms of the False Claims Act, in terms of how that would be approached. And so I'll follow up with more of that tomorrow when we speak.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. All right, for the final question of the day, Representative Sadler.
Oh, goodness, sir, I've got so many questions. I almost
we'll have another seven meetings.
I understand. You know, with that, Mr. Chair, I think I'll defer till then. That makes more sense.
Well, thank you.
All right. Ms. Shattuck, I want to thank you so much, and Ms. Crayley. I mean, Ms. Shattuck, the tremendous amount of work you put into this for the last year is just incredible, and your presentation was wonderful. I want to thank you very much. Any further comments or closing comments?
Thank you, Chair Thompson, for hearing this bill, and we look forward to working with all House Finance members on making this a better bill. So, thank you.
Thank you, and we'll now set Senate Bill 74 aside at this time. Our next House Committee Finance meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, March 22nd at 9:30 a.m. At that meeting, we will be having second hearings on the following bills. House Bill 268, ADA, Dividend to State Income Valuation. House Bill 143, ADA Bonds, Loans, Fund, and AEA Loan. And Senate Bill 53, Advanced Practice Registered Nurses. And we will also be hearing for the first time House Bill 351, Adoption of Regulations, Limitations, and Void Regulations by Representative Pruitt. And with that, at 3:32 p.m., we are adjourned.